Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, it all began with The Power of One, a practice novel that served as a doorstop before it was discovered and became a publishing sensation, selling millions of copies in 11 languages and making it onto the big screen. Since then, Bryce Courtney has averaged one book every year, producing titles like The Potato Factory, Jessica, Tandier, April Fool's Day, Matthew Flinders Cat, so many others. His latest book is called The Story of Danny Dunn, and it's a pleasure to welcome Bryce Courtney to Open House to talk about it. Bryce, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Sheridan, and thank you for having me.
You prefer to be called a storyteller rather than a writer. Why so?
Because there's so much pomposity about writing, Sheridan. You know, there are supposedly those who can and those who can't, and those who qualify for literature and those who don't. And basically, my contention is, since the dawn of time, there has been one immovable object, and that is called the storyteller. We are necessary to the societies in which we live, and we don't need to be classified because we tell the stories of our people, and that's how I see myself.
Yeah, well, you've been telling stories since the dawn of your time, haven't you? You really started telling stories to protect yourself as a kid.
Yes, I discovered that, you know, that words can be very powerful when your life is in danger. Because, you know, I literally started one day when some huge hulk was about to beat me to pulp, and I put my hands up and said, "Don't hit me and I'll tell you a story." And it worked, and I continued to tell stories as long as I lived in the orphanage, and it saved my skin in so many times that I guess as a child I discovered the power of the word. People love stories. And, yes. And you know, Sheridan, I see myself in terms of being an entertainer. I simply entertain people. This concept of you'll be there for posterity and they'll read you in hundreds of years' time, it's absolute codswallop, you know. The tide comes in twice a day and it washes out all the footprints on the beach, mate.
Let's talk about that story that you had then. You were born as an illegitimate child in South Africa, 1933. Obviously, very, very different times to today. So that meant, you know, it was an interesting upbringing you had.
Well, you know, people say, oh, you poor old, you know, you had a rough beginning. You know, it was 1933. It was still the Depression. There was no such thing as Social Security of any sort. You know, if a woman had an illegitimate child, she was a pariah in the society. She had no support system. She could draw on nothing. Her only chance was to take this child into care somewhere, and that's exactly what my mother did. You can't blame her for it, except if you want to blame her for the original indiscretion, and I'm very happy that she had it.
Well, it was a nice kind of outcome of that, wasn't there?
Well, you know, thankfully it was me.
Your mum actually did suffer with some form of mental illness, didn't she?
Yeah, I now realise she was bipolar. In those days, they used to refer to it as nervous breakdowns, but basically it was bipolar, and so she would be in and out of, if you like, places where you went for nervous breakdowns, and she really wasn't brilliantly equipped to take care of children, and so, you know, you just accept that was your lot in life, and that's how it happened, and it could have been worse. You know, I was never sexually abused in an institution, and when we said sorry the other day to all these poor kids who went through institutions very similar to mine, and you realize how many of them were actually sexually abused, that never happened to me. But it's curious, Sheridan, when I look back and I see the discombobulation of so many families, I sometimes think, well, maybe it was quite a good thing not to have a dad and a mum. Because, you know, there is so much, you know, so many dislocated families in this world and where things go wrong. I mean, I would have hated to have had an alcoholic father or mother or something like that. I think that could be just too ghastly for words.
So how, apart from, say, the story, The Power of One, of course, a good deal of it was autobiographical, how has those early days then, of the fact that you didn't have biological mum and dad around, how have they made you who you are today and therefore made you the writer or the storyteller that you are today?
Sheridan, that's both a good question and a difficult one to answer, but I'll try. I think the point is that we grow up, I'm talking a normal family grows up with the expectations of their family, whether they be high or low, doesn't really matter. But the point is we are brainwashed into knowing who we are, what we do, what we're capable of, and where we're going to go, and where we sit in society. So those are pro formas which exist for the average family. Mm-hmm. I had none of that. You know, I knew I was at the bottom of the rung, and I also knew that I had the one privilege that few of us have. I could reinvent myself. I could actually be anything I wanted to be, providing I got the breaks. And I did get a couple of very good breaks, and, you know, scholarships to private mm-hmm. school from an orphanage, and then again to university. So I got the breaks, but I didn't have the inhibitions. I didn't have to, your dad was a plumber, so you'll be a plumber's mm-hmm. son. Mm-hmm. I could, in a sense, be everything. And because I had discovered the power of the word, so to speak, so early, I never ever wanted to be anything but a storyteller, right from the very beginning. So I had a direction, and I didn't have anything that could inhibit that direction other than myself. The other thing that comes with that kind of background is mate, if you start at the bottom, you're not scared. Mm. Everybody is scared of slipping backwards. I know where backwards is, you know. I was born with a thump onto the ground. So in essence, I've never been afraid of what might happen. I always realized I'd be able to cope.
Yes.
You know, there are disadvantages, obviously. I mean, I desperately needed to be loved, and I was desperately lonely. But in terms of fear of life, fear of consequences, they've never worried me. And I think that's helped me enormously, because I've always said, okay, you know, I'll survive. I can survive. I know how to survive. I've been there.
Fascinating. Bryce Courtney is with us on Open House tonight, theopenhouse.net.au. Before we leave this family situation, a few years ago you ran full-page ads in South African newspapers looking for your dad.
Yeah, well, you know, rather presumptuously, I ran these pages saying famous author requires to know.
How many responses did you get all wanting to know this famous author?
I got responses from my dad's family, which was amazing, because on her deathbed, my mother had told me what his surname was, which wasn't Courtney, by the way. It was Cunningham Ryder. Courtney was my grandmother's surname, and that's why she just took it and put it on my birth certificate for want of her own particular maiden name. Yeah. And so I fleshed out four half-brothers and five sisters who responded, but only one of them would talk to me, which is very curious. And she told me a whole lot about my father and who he was and what he was and why he was. And this one half-sister who, to my enormous regret, died 6 months after I met her, filled me in enormously because she was interested in her family. And so for the first time in my life, as a man of, 65 at the stage, I think, I suddenly had a complete picture of my antecedents, where I came from, and who, in fact, I was. And it's quite an alarming thing to happen that late in life, when you've kind of been, when you've been reinventing yourself almost on each decade. You say, well, what am I now? Where am I now? How am I now? To suddenly find that there is a continuity there, and that you look like somebody, and you have some reactions according to her, very much like your father. And that just seemed very curious and very strange.
Of course, many adopted children, or children who are adopted into families, find the same thing when they're able to make contact with their birth mother or father too. And so who do you think you were before that moment? How had you built your identity? Had it just been kind of predominantly on what you'd done, what you'd made of yourself, what you'd succeeded in?
You know, the joy of self-invention is that at first, of course, as a child, you exaggerate your importance because you have none and you imagine things that it couldn't possibly be. But as you get older and wiser, you get very real about who you are and what your capacities are and what you think you can do and how you should look at things, because everything comes to you freshly, Sharon. It's not like you have your mother's viewpoint or your father's viewpoint to carry on. You know, you don't have a political affiliation. You don't come from anything. You don't have any of the stuff that we carry with us from generation to generation. So I think you become very much a realist. You realize that you do have capacities, but you also have limitations. Mm-hmm. And very few people actually ask themselves, who the hell am I?
Mm.
Because they've been indoctrinated to be told what they have to think and who they actually are. They've been told secondhand who they are, and a lot of them as children accept that and carry on with that. Yes. I didn't have to do that.
Yes, yes.
I could actually say, okay, now answer yourself honestly. Who are you? What do you think? What is your opinion about this? How will you react to that? And so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's interesting that as we talk, the conversation that we had with David Bassot, the guy who founded Opportunity International, the micro-enterprise.
Mate, what a wonderful man.
What an amazing story, amazing man, and amazing work that they do. And, you know, so much of what you've just said, he almost said himself, in the sense that he also grew up in an orphanage. He was able to invent himself. He was able to make himself who he wanted to be. Of course, there are downsides of not having biological mum and dad around, but there can be some redemption out of it, and obviously that's what you're saying.
Yeah, Sheridan, we hear the sad stories and we watch people sobbing on television and saying how tough it was. But like everything, there's heads and tails, and you have to make choices in life.
Mm.
And some people make choices and they go down, and others make choices and happily they go up. But we have to make choices. It's that not having to make choices in the middle that I think is where the problem lies. For so many of us, we end up unhappy, we make unhappy partnerships, we do jobs which are deadly boring, and we carry on in perpetuity without questioning why we're doing this.
Mm. This is Open House, and Bryce Courtney is our special guest. His new book, The Story of Danny Dunn, we're going to get to in a second. You made a decision to come to Australia, but to some degree it was because you were banned from going back to South Africa. Tell me about that.
Yeah, curiously enough, Sheridan, I mean, it is absurd when you think about it, but I had started a school for Africans on the weekend in this posh boarding school where I won a scholarship to go from the orphanage.
Mm.
And because I could speak three African languages, because it just happens the orphanage was sort of on the junction of Swaziland and Zululand and the Shangaan people, I could speak those three languages, which amounts to speaking all the languages in Africa, because Zulu and Khoisa are very much the same. So I was able to communicate, whereas most white South Africans at the time couldn't speak an African language. And I'd started this school for Africans who worked at all the jobs that white people wouldn't do and loved doing it, and they loved coming. And the police raided it and said it had to stop, and eventually said if I didn't stop the school, that they'd actually close down the school, the whole school. So Father Huddleston, who later became the Bishop of London, was then a Anglican minister in Soweto. And he said, come and do your school on Sunday mornings after service in Soweto. And so I'd take the bus out to Soweto and do this. And the police burnt down the church hall.
Mm.
And then when I got a scholarship to go overseas, Colonel Pretorius came to the school and said, if you come back here, we know you're a communist, because only a communist would start a school for Africans. I probably didn't know there were two M's in communists at the time. And he said, if you come back, we're going to place you under house arrest, so you better make up your mind to find another place. And so, well, you know, I didn't have this enormous brief for South Africa. I didn't have that. Those Aleutian times in South Africa. It had been a tough growing up, period. And so I was free again to reinvent myself and say, here we go, I can find a new country that suits me. And I have a very curious story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a pub in Chelsea one night, and this absolutely astonishingly looking woman and chap, he was one of those people who, although he wasn't bald and he wasn't fat, looked as though he was going to be bald and fat. You know, those are those people. You can always tell how they're going to turn out. But the woman was astonishingly gorgeous,
mm-hmm.
and she must have been 6'1". And they were speaking in broad Australian accents, and I could hear them because they were fairly loud, and I edged up. And they were talking to each other about how Australia was a cultural desert, how they'd come to England and they were going to Cambridge and they were going to stay in England because there was nothing left for them in Australia.
Uh-huh.
There's this this cultural desert. And I thought, well, I'm not much chopped. Maybe I could do okay in a cultural desert. So that was one of the first decisions I ever had.
Seemed like the right place for you.
To come to Australia. And, of course, when I came here, I loved it from the very second, from the very moment I arrived. The sky rose forever, and Sydney Harbour was like a mill pond. And I said, you're never going to, this may be a cultural desert, but I ain't leaving. And that was 50 years ago.
Let's talk about the move to become a writer, of course. You always wanted to be a writer, a storyteller.
Well, always a storyteller.
A storyteller, yes. Let me do that right. Yeah, yes.
Writing was just a medium. Yes.
So you trained in journalism, then you made your name in advertising, and who can forget Louis the Fly, your creation. So why did it take until your 30s to be able to do this full-time?
Well, there's a very simple reason. Sharon and I, on my 29th birthday, close to it, Damon, my youngest son, was born, and he was born a classic hemophiliac, and we didn't have the structures in those days to look after somebody who was that chronically ill. I mean, he used to have a blood transfusion three times a week. And I realized that if I was to become a writer, which was my plan, the following year that was, that I would probably never make enough money to support him and let him grow up in as healthy a way as it was possible. And so I postponed what had been absolutely the life plan until the year he died, when I wrote Power of One, and that was 27 years later. So really, people say, why do you write a book every year? And I say, because I'm trying to catch up.
Yes.
And I've only written 19 in 20 years. That means there are 8 to go yet. but that's actually what happened. Yeah. And when he died, I was able to return to that original intention and become a writer.
And it was Damon's life that was the subject of course, April Fool's Day as well.
Oh, Sheridan, mate, that was... Writing that book, if all books were April Fool's Day, I would not be a writer. It was just too hard. It was just too hard. He begged me to write it. He was so appalled when he got into the hospital system, and remember, he got the HIV virus from a blood transfusion, as did all 418 haemophiliacs who are dead now in Australia. They all got it from a thing called factor 8, which was imported from America, which is the clotting factor in blood. And suddenly he was in the hospital system, and he met for the first time the gay fraternity, or people who are gay. And he found them nice, lovely, ordinary people who are being castigated and who are being brutalized in the hospital system. And he begged me, he said, Dad, you have to tell people that this is a virus. It's not an act of God. It's a virus. And I said, oh, Damon, I can't do that. I can't. Our family is much too private. You know, we can't speak out like this because I'd have to tell the truth about everything. And on the day he died, on April the 1st, he was in my arms. And Damon was about 5'10". And he weighed 43 pounds and I held him in my arms, knowing he was dying. And he looked up at me and he said, Dad, please sing our song. Now, I used to sing a song to him when he was in pain as a child, and I sang it all his life. And so I paused for a moment and I said, summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high. Your daddy's rich and your mama's good looking. So hush, little baby, don't you cry. One of these mornings, you're going to rise up singing. Then you'll spread your wings and you'll reach for the sky. But until that time, why, nothing can harm you. 'Cause Mommy and Daddy are standing by. And he looked up at me and he said, Dad, thank you for a wonderful life, but please, please write the book. And he died in my arms then.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how that book got written. And he was right and I was wrong, Sheridan. And that book did so much good in terms of changing people's attitudes about HIV and about AIDS and worldwide. Yeah. And, you know, it's been printed in several languages now and sold a great many copies.
Tens of thousands of letters in response, didn't you?
I got, I think, at last count, about 33,000 letters.
Yeah.
And you discover immediately, Sheridan, that, you know, you think you're doing it tough, but some of those letters were... I have a huge respect. Almost every family has a tragedy, but ever since that moment, I have... had huge respect for those selfless carers, people who care about selflessly for people who can't care for themselves. And without them, our medical system would just break down. And, you know, I have started a prize or a fund or a foundation called the Power of One Foundation, which is a prize of $50,000 for anybody who does one of these selfish tasks and never talks about it and just gets on with it. Those amazing people. So if anybody listening has anybody in your community or you know him who is doing this sort of thing for the good of the community, for the good of others, unselfishly, unfailingly, and not begging, wanting a handout, please get onto my website because they could put their names in to win the $50,000 we give away every year.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Open House. Right across the nation, theopenhouse.net.au, you're listening to the master storyteller himself, Bryce Courtney, who's with us, and his new book is called The Story of Danny Dunn. We should mention that, shouldn't we now, Bryce? I mean...
Oh, that'd be nice, mate. you don't have to. It's okay.
All these amazing other stories that you're telling us as we lead up to that. I mean, nothing probably, like you said, has been so heartrending to write as April Fool's Day.
Oh, couldn't do that again.
No.
I just couldn't do that again.
No.
People say to me, why don't you write an autobiography? And I say, well, you know, in part I've done that in April Fool's Day, but Morris West, who was a mate of mine, I once asked him the same question. He was in his 80s and still writing, and I said, Morris, you know, you've had a fabulous career as a writer. Why don't you write your autobiography? We need it. We must have it.
Mm.
And he used to call everybody, male and female, darling, and he said, oh, darling, he said, I don't much care for the central character. but I just couldn't write another April Fool's Day. It would be too hard, you know.
Yes.
You know, when you spill your life out like that, you have to tell the truth. And, you know, there are lots of things I've done I'd rather not have people know about, as most people have.
Yes,
you know?
Of course. So, Danny Dunn, tell us about the lad from Balmain. Introduce him to us. You've described him as a kind of a conglomeration of so much of what was happening around wartime Australia.
Well, you know, there is an archetypical male that existed almost from the beginning of when convicts arrived to perhaps the 70s and even the early 80s, but certainly the 70s or post Vietnam War anyway, and who came back from one conflict to another, and it goes right back to the first convicts. And today we have a posh name for it called post-traumatic stress disorder. But in actual fact, it's this deep depression and mental illness, really, that comes from war and from those kinds of vicissitudes. So the convicts had to have it. The people in the gold rush, a lot of the men who came out and found out that, you know, there wasn't any gold and they were destitute and they couldn't recover and they spent their lives trying to make up for this. That was it again. And then we have the First World War and the Second World War and the Great Depression, Korea and Malaya and finally Vietnam. And so when you look at it this way, Sheridan, every single generation of Australian has had 10 or 15% of its young males have come back deeply damaged, deeply damaged in one way or another. And any sociologist will tell you that that is enough to permeate right through an entire system. Mm. And so, in essence, what it means is that we are different for reasons. We are Australians for reasons that are quite different to being Canadians or South Africans or Americans or New Zealanders. Those differences are what make us who we are. And Danny Dunn is, in a sense, archetypically one of those men. He starts out as a kid who appears to have everything. He goes to war. He is physically and mentally broken. He comes back. He has to pick up the pieces. But more importantly, his wife or the woman he marries has to pick up the pieces mm-hmm. and look after the kids. And so here we have that archetypical, again, female, the strong Australian woman who has held everything together for generation after generation after generation. Were it not for her, we would be an entirely different people. Mm-hmm. You know, when I go overseas, I play a little game, which is I say to people, tell me about your family. Almost 100% of the time, they'll start by telling you about their dad. Ask any Australian, and he'll start by telling you about his mum. Mm-hmm. Because we are, in that sense, a matriarchal society.
I think you're right there.
The strong woman who pulled us through, because a lot of the males had real problems, had alcohol problems, bearing, if you like, the problems that mental problems that they had from the war or whatever the circumstances were. And mum had to field it. Mum had to take care of the kids, give them their ambitions, see them through, manage somehow. And, you know, and also create this tough love, which is an Australian idea, but it's a wonderful idea. And so the Australian woman is really something, if you read my books, I keep celebrating, because she is a quite remarkable creature.
Yes. Yes, I think that really comes through as I was flicking through. I only got the book this week, so I was only able to spend a little bit of time looking through it, but certainly the character of Helen came through as this very strong, she's the level-headed one.
Absolutely. You know, she has to run things. Things have to work, you know. Yeah. Bread has to come on the table, you know. And you know, there are downsides to this. We still, as a nation, from the age of 15 onwards, right now, and I'm talking 2009, we are consuming 9 litres of pure alcohol a year. Hmm. Now, the period that I was talking about, that would be almost have been double that. So grog, if you like, that institutional Australian thing has been a problem from day one. Mm-hmm. And you know, because I am an Australian and because I write about my people, you're trying to get those truths through, not because they're condemnatory, because they're not. They're just who we are.
It's part of the story.
And when we know who we are, we have a far better idea of how to behave and also where we might be going.
Yeah, I had to laugh when I opened up to one of the pages, Bryce, and noticed that Danny Dunn goes into politics and the researcher assigned to Danny's campaign is a young researcher named Hugh McKay.
Oh, right. Yeah, I love to do things like that.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, because you know, he fit it in the right time frame and Hugh's a friend of mine, so why not?
Yeah. Okay, so that's the story of Danny Dunn, and you've said that you have got so many books to do before that final curtain, I guess, is drawn. You've got a pretty heavy writing discipline these days. Do you still get up at 4:30 in the morning?
Yeah, you know, it's the only way I'm going to ever do it, mate. You know, the drapes for that final curtain, I can almost see them from the corner of my eye. Mm. And I have to say to myself, you haven't got a lot of time, mate, so get going. So, yes, I for 7 months a year, I write 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. And then, of course, I have 5 months off, or some of it off anyway. So it's not that tough, but it's the only way I can get a book out every year. And really, I have so many questions I yet have to ask myself, and hopefully people would like to read about.
Yeah. Like what? I mean, just briefly, what are some of the themes that are still to be worked out?
The next question in the next book for me is, although I haven't really got it in my mind yet, is, we have these Asian neighbours. How do they fit in? How do we regard them? What do we really think about them? You know, are we deeply suspicious? Is there, you know, there are a whole heap of questions we need to ask. So I think probably I'll be including Hong Kong and Singapore and Thailand mm-hmm. and the Philippines and Indonesia, and which I've been peripherizing for a while now. I've been going there and coming back. I think it's time to sort of get hold of that subject mm-hmm. and have a real look at it and see how, as Australians, we fit in. We're in the wrong, for Caucasians, we're in the wrong part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we've survived uniquely. Why is that?
Yeah, just some of the things that are musing through your mind. Here's one out of left field before we wrap up our conversation, Bryson. I do appreciate your time because it's been very generous of you. People often will say, and I remember Michael Lunig saying this to me, that the older he got, the more and more he started to think about faith matters. Now, I've never quite been able to work out if you've got a position there. Do you have a religious leaning, or do you think you might explore that more as time goes on, or what?
I think Lunig is probably one of the very few original geniuses we have in Australia. And I admire him enormously. But I can't share that viewpoint with him. I have no sense of faith. I was in the orphanage. I was born into a Calvinistic regimen, which is very strict, the Dutch Reformed Church, and very onerous and very Old Testament. And I think I had all the religion I could take by the time I was 11. I haven't revisited that area. That doesn't mean for one moment that I don't admire people who have faith.
Sure,
I do.
Sure.
And respect them for having it. It's just that I don't.
Yes, yes. And it goes back to those experiences as a child, hey?
I think so. I think, you know, religion for me always meant punishment.
Mm.
Always. It was Old Testament, it was wrath, the wrath of God. And I understand the wrath of God very well, but I've never actually come to terms with the love of it, of him or her. But that doesn't mean I don't respect other people for doing that.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm not anti-religion. I'm just, it hasn't touched me.
Yeah, and not something that you've ever wanted to explore further, like to see the other side, like the love of God,
you know,
side?
I will, for instance, often go into a Catholic church and just sit in and listen to High Mass if I happen to be in Rome or somewhere, because it is so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It is so astonishingly beautiful. I love some of the hymns, some of the classical hymns. I just absolutely love them.
Mm.
But again, it's an esoteric thing. It's not a deeply religious thing.
Yes, more of an aesthetic thing as well.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, it's been so good to talk to you, Bryce.
Sheridan, it's always lovely to talk to you, mate.
Yeah, thanks so much
and
for
you
your
ask,
time.
You ask lovely questions, so thank you for that.
You tell amazing stories.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, mate. Have a lovely Christmas, won't you?
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks
Bye.
So much. That's Bryce Courtney, whose latest book is called The Story of Danny Dunn.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.